Colgate-Palmolive. Colgate is here today to implement, not relitigate, this court's prior opinion. That opinion left several issues still to be resolved to calculate plaintiff's retirement benefits.
I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you. Do you mind making sure you're speaking in the mic? I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course, Your Honor. Is that better?
Much better. Thank you so much.
So this prior court's opinion left several issues still to be resolved to calculate the benefits. And so the parties worked together to identify 20 different steps for that calculation. They agreed on 18 of them, disagreeing on only two, which now serve the basis for this appeal. Because neither of these two issues were decided by this court against Colgate, the district court erred in applying the law of the case doctrine.
Is the question whether they were decided or whether they were sort of within the scope of what could have been decided, what could have been raised and decided?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think they were not expressly decided against Colgate. And actually, indeed, this court's opinion, if you follow it faithfully, supports Colgate's positions on both issues. So the first issue is whether Colgate can apply a pre-retirement mortality discount to a residual annuity benefit taken at an early age. Now, this is a different calculation than the lump sum calculation at issue before. But under the guidance of this court's opinion, mortality discount is appropriate here because in contrast to the lump sum, a residual annuity is not paid to a participant's beneficiaries in the event of a pre-retirement death.
So respond to this argument. That's all well and good, but when we argued about the pre, and when I say we, I mean you, the pre-retirement mortality discount before, the original complaint raised both of them as of a piece. It's true that the briefing and the discussion focused on one, but there was never any argument to the court that, oh, by the way, even if you rule against us on the AE of the LS, you should still rule for us on the adjustment to the age 65 annuity to the actual retirement. Is that, first of all, is that an accurate description of the facts? And if so, why doesn't that end your argument there?
So it was plaintiff's decision in their dispositive summary judgment motion to only raise the issue of the lump sum. And their abandonment of the residual annuity calculation was strategic because they made an argument to the district court.
Does that mean that you couldn't argue it? I mean, does that prevent you from arguing it just because they abandoned it, if we agree that it was abandoned?
So Colgate had no obligation, no incentive to respond to an argument that plaintiffs didn't raise.
But isn't the standard that you were prevented from?
No, Your Honor, but that was not an issue at the case because they made an argument that only applies to the lump sum. If you take their argument, which this court adopted in its last opinion, and you apply it in this new calculation to this new benefit, it doesn't hold water because the residual annuity calculation doesn't have a death benefit. It doesn't pay out the same upon a pre-retirement death. So because of this is how the plaintiffs chose to litigate their complaint, they're the masters of their complaint, we lost and we concede that, but you then now have to implement this court's prior opinion. And in following the logic, the basis, the rationale of that opinion to the new residual annuity benefit, that there's no dispute, you don't get it if you die before electing your retirement benefits, then the answer is clear. It should be allowed, it's provided for in the plain text of the plan, and it's not precluded under ERISA or any other means.
So we're sort of, you know, we sort of have two conversations at once here. One is the sort of, is it law of the case and do we get to the merits? And then the second is the merits. So assuming for a second we get to the merits, I'm trying to get my head around your argument a little bit where the residual annuity is a makeup benefit for a shortfall in payments under retirement plan that doesn't, that is payable on death to someone, so there's no reduction, isn't that the relevant consideration rather than the residual annuity itself? Or what am I missing about that?
Sure, Your Honor. So it's important to understand the different context and the different purpose of the two different calculations. So the first calculation, which was the only one at issue before, was taking the actuarial equivalent of the lump sum. You're converting a lump sum into an annuity, and this court held you couldn't apply a mortality discount because your lump sum is paid out regardless of death. That part of that calculation created what's called the age 65 residual annuity. That was that subtraction equation. It was the accrued benefits minus the AE of LS. That's what makes you whole. That's the mismatch. What we're talking about today is a different calculation in kind. For the subset of Colgate retirees that elected to retire early, before 65, they get a value in that because if they had not retired early and waited to 65, there's a chance they could have died and neither them nor their beneficiaries would have got that additional residual annuity.
Which I think and I realize there's sort of the hypothetical universe and then the real world and they're sort of interacting here, but the residual annuity is only relevant, right, for people who have retired and taken the lump sum. It's not something that's, am I missing that? Like prospectively, people who haven't yet retired alive aren't getting a residual
annuity. So the residual annuity can apply prospectively. And it's important to remember when you're applying this court's opinion about when a discount is appropriate, and there's no dispute it's in the text of the RAA. The question is, what happens if you die before electing your lump sum, before you take retirement? And if you die before you elect your lump sum, as is contemplated under the RAA, you don't get a death benefit. And that's valuable. And if you don't apply that discount to those that desire to retire early, you're overinflating the value of that annuity, and you're giving them more than make whole. And that's what this court actually noted. And going to your question, Your Honor, about the intersection between the law of the case and the merits,
yeah.
I think they come together because if you apply this court's opinion, specifically the hypothetical they provide, they say that a mortality discount is appropriate with, quote, a plan with no survivorship, a plan in which the member's rights to collect her accrued benefit does not pass to her surviving beneficiary in the event of her premature death. That's at page 698 of 62F4th. Now, why would the court have provided that hypothetical that precisely describes the calculation we're talking about today if it was, you know, at issue and already decided against Colgate?
Okay, let me go back to the law of the case and just get your reaction to this. I look at the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, and they ask for summary judgment on error 3 of the complaint, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number 6. I don't see the defendants argued that the two mortality discount calculations that are identified in error 3 are subject to a different analysis. I don't see any effort to counter error 3. So when you say that plaintiffs abandon error 3, I guess, am I understanding you to say that even though they specifically asked for summary judgment on error 3 because they didn't affirmatively make arguments about error 3 as it relates to this particular context, your failure to make any arguments as to this particular context is of no moment?
A chronology of events may be helpful here, Your Honor.
Sure.
Because remember, Colgate first brought its own summary judgment motion as a defendant. It was not dispositive. It won on some issues. It lost on some issues. It left some to still be decided. And plaintiffs concede, and this is in the appendix page 812 and 1118, that motion for summary judgment that Colgate brought only included the AE of LS, only included the lump sum. Now, when plaintiffs moved for summary judgment, knowing that we had only moved on one of the two, they asked for the very same thing. They wanted the mirror image of what the court decided. They did not add to their motion that we also want this to apply to the residual annuity. And that was strategic because it allowed them to make this argument, which prevailed, is that you look at whether the underlying benefit, the lump sum, has a death benefit, pays to your beneficiaries. They could not have made that argument and won
with respect to
the residual annuity.
So when you say they made the strategic judgment not to pursue the PMDS argument as it related to this age 65 reducing to early retirement, Where is it, because I looked at the motion itself and it references error 3 and error 3 includes that. So is there some place where they, that you can point me to that, that sort of documents what you're describing they've done, which is to make a deliberate decision not to ask the court for relief as to this other issue?
So the only issue they argued was about lump sum, which again only applies to one of two.
Right.
And I think the evidence that this was not decided, and remember issues that are not decided by this court are not law of the case, is on, let's see, in the first district court opinion on in appendix 1058, the district court said, here a PRMD is used to determine the present value of the age 65 AE of LS paid, a benefit that must be paid in all events and does not decrease if the participant dies prior to reaching age 65. And again, in this court's prior opinion, and you can look at that on page 699, they say that the use is improper where, quote, Colgate's use of a PRMD to determine the present value of the lump sum, end quote. And that's what this court determined. It left the hypothetical open for what's now the residual annuity calculation.
Okay. That sort of leads back into the merits, and I understand your argument. I think maybe we have different views of, I understand law of the case not to only encompass issues that were specifically decided, but also to encompass issues that were ripe for review for decision
right.
that were foregone.
And I think, Your Honor, I think it's important to remember we're not asking, again, to relitigate arguments we could have raised. We're asking to implement what this court decided, adopting the plaintiff's interpretation, and you apply that to this calculation, it just doesn't hold water. It's not the same.
Okay, thank you. And we're gonna get a chance to hear back from you again in rebuttal. So we'll hear from attorney. All right, I blew it on the last one. Is it Diane?
Diane.
All right.
Diane, thank you. May it please the court. This court should affirm the district court's decision rejecting both of Colgate's new arguments. Judge Schofield was right to reject the arguments both on law of the case grounds and on the merits. Just by way of background to orient us just very briefly, it's now undisputed that in the 1990s, Colgate shortchanged its employees when it converted their pensions to lump sums. And we're here now, 30 years after the fact, because Colgate's repeatedly tried to avoid full responsibility and make the class members fully whole for that gap. And the gap at issue is the gap between what they were paid back in the 90s and the value of their age 65 pensions. In 2023, this court in the prior opinion rejected the most sweeping effort to escape from this. And Colgate's two new arguments also deserve to be rejected. They are absolutely arguments that could have been made before. I'll start, unless the court...
What about their claim that, well, we don't have to, it's your motion for summary judgment, we don't have to make arguments that aren't implicated by the request for relief that you're seeking. It's up to you to identify the issues for resolution.
Yeah, and I think there's a short answer to that, and then there's a little bit of a longer answer to it. The short answer is that the motion for summary judgment that the plaintiffs made stated, and you you have to file a notice of motion and then a brief. And the motion papers said that the plaintiff seeks summary judgment on count 2, error 3. There was no limitation. It didn't say count 2, part of error 3. It said count 2, error 3. That was the motion on August 4th, 2020. Then Judge Schofield granted summary judgment on all of count 2, error 3. No qualification, no limitation. That's the issue, that's the judgment that was on review in Colgate. And I'll just say this, that the way that the system is supposed to work is that if the plaintiff or whoever the moving party is files a motion for summary judgment and seeks a specific kind of relief, namely here all of a claim, which was the error 3 claim is clearly delineated in the complaint. There's no dispute about that. It's incumbent on the opposing party to say, well, hey, wait a second. The motion is seeking summary judgment on all of error 3, and yet if they really believe this, and yet the brief doesn't get them all the way to the finish line. That was the place to do it, in the opposition brief. And if we go back in time, and this is the longer part of the answer, I think there's a whole kind of through the looking glass narrative where there's an abandonment by our side, when that just is not a proper reading of the record. And I'll just say incidentally that Judge Schofield's reading of this is obviously consistent with ours, and it deserves great respect under this court's cases, under the standard of review that even Colgate acknowledges applies to this kind of case. So that chronology goes like this. You start with the complaint. It has count two. It has error three. In the complaint, error three very clearly says there are two conceptually identical adjustments to the that are made under the residual annuity amendment, called alternatively the PRMD or the projection for survivorship. So error three states that there are these two distinct.
I'm curious about the use of that term, because it seemed to be in the complaint it used the PRMD to describe one of the two calculations, and it used mortality discount or some other term for the others, and now it seems like we're using PRMD for both.
Yeah, so that's relevant. So if you start with error three, the complaint states technically that there's that actuaries use it. Well, you know, the sticklers use a different terminology for two conceptually identical calculations. That's error three. Now, fast forward. Colgate moves for summary judgment first. Colgate's motion for summary judgment, and this is something that is elided from their briefs to the point where they won't cite the document, they'll only cite the docket entry. If you look at the motion for summary judgment filed by Colgate, it asks for summary judgment on all of count two, not on count two, errors one, two, part of three and four, all of count two. In response, and this is crucial, in response, the plaintiffs say in their brief and in their Rule 56.1 statement, I'll start with the brief. In the plaintiff's brief, they say there are two distinct issues implicated by that single error. The parties have been calling both of them PRMD as a shorthand. So now we're alerting everyone. We're calling the PRMD is what we're calling both pieces of the calculation. Colgate files a reply, doesn't contest that that's an appropriate summary or shorthand of how the parties are referring to the issue. Okay? That's the next step. Colgate loses summary judgment. The plaintiffs then move, and now we're back to where I started, with a clear notice of motion that asks for summary judgment on count two, error three. That is exactly when, if Colgate thought that a piece of this was abandoned, it needed to speak up. Now, I'll just say this. I'd like to talk about the merits of this for a moment, because I think on the merits, the position of Colgate is absolutely wrong, and it's not coherent, and it's not faithful to what happened. There was, as Your Honor pointed out, there was no strategic judgment on the plaintiff's part to not make this argument, and the reason is simple. The question of whether, if ever, you can apply a PRMD turns on whether the underlying plan document provides the beneficiary of a participant with a benefit, a death benefit, that is substantially equivalent to the participant's age 65 pension benefit. That is the question. And this court answered it. It couldn't have been clearer. This court said, interpreting this very plan, of course, that it said that in this plan, I'm going to get the exact quote here. In the event of a member's death, this is on page 699. In the event of a member's death, her beneficiary would receive a benefit that is effectively equal to the accrued benefit, such that the beneficiary steps into the participant's shoes and is entitled to her entire pension benefit. So this plan meets the prerequisite of a plan as to which no PRMD is appropriate. Now, what I hear my friend saying is, well, that somehow they can survive the reasoning of Colgate 1, because what they say is that the residual annuity is not paid in the event that someone, a participant, dies before electing their benefit. But if a participant dies before electing their benefit, their beneficiary gets the full value of the age 65 pension. And the full value of the age 65 pension equals the deficient lump sum plus the residual annuity. That's how Judge Schofield explained it, and it's irrefutable, and we haven't heard an answer to that argument. So, that's really, I think, the core on error three on the merits. We haven't talked about the 20 plus one interest rate issue. I think that's perhaps even easier. So in that case, on that issue, Judge Schofield said quite clearly that the 20 plus 1% rate is the rate for determining the account plus employee contribution benefit in Appendix C2B2. She didn't say that was just the rate for calculating the employer contribution component of the benefit. She said that was how you calculate the entire benefit.
Well, what I struggled with a little bit with the language of the plan is this employee contribution was kind of an add-on to deal with the scenario of the grandfathered people. And so it seems like the way the account is defined, it's contemplating the contributions made over time on behalf of the employee by the employer.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like the employee contributions are either defined to be part of that account or not to be part of that account. It just seems like they're there as another thing
that could
come into play in a certain scenario.
Yeah, they are tracked as if they were in the account. They're the functional equivalent of the account. The SPD states that they're the functional equivalent of the account. And the most important point here is that even if you treat them as not technically in the account, there's still only one plausible and reasonable interpretation of Appendix C2B2. Because Appendix C2B2 says that the age 65 benefit for this group of people is the actuarial equivalent, and that's a defined term in the plan, is the, quote, actuarial equivalent of the accrued benefit and the employee contributions. So the reason that there's still only one reasonable reading is that that term actuarially equivalent is defined in one place in the plan, and that's in section 1.3. So what C2B2 is doing is it's telling the reader, look to where it's defined in the main plan document. That's 1.3. 1.3 is where you find the 20 plus 1 rate. It's the only place you can find a rate for that. On the law of the case issue, I'll just say that this is even more straightforward than the merits. And I think the point I'm about to make relates to both. It's undisputed that Colgate in real time, and this was in the earlier panel opinion, it's undisputed that Colgate during the relevant period in the 90s, as these class members were actually leaving and getting benefit statements, that Colgate was using the 20 plus 1 rate for every component of this, including the employee contribution component. So on the merits, departing from that would be arbitrary, as this court already held. On the law of the case issue, we have heard nothing from Colgate as to why it could not have raised this point if it really believed the employee contribution was different. And I think Your Honor pointed to a summary of the court's jurisprudence on law of the case in the Acorn case, which was just last year, which is that the mandate rule applies both to, quote, issues explicitly or implicitly decided on appeal and to issues that were ripe for review, that's the phrase, at the time of initial review, but nonetheless foregone by a party. There's nothing that opposing counsel has been able to say as to why they couldn't have raised both of these issues then. And I'll submit with that.
All right. We appreciate your arguments. Okay. Attorney Ziemer.
Your Honors, just three quick points for rebuttal. And I'll start with the last point on the employee contributions. Section 1.3 of the plan that was just addressed only governs the cash balance account. It's only the 20 plus 1 is explicitly tied to the cash balance account. It does not cover employee contributions. So after this court's opinion, the plan administrator took the guidance from this court, took the text of the plan, and said, okay, well, I now have to apply 20 plus 1 to the cash balance. The plan's silent with respect to employee contributions, Elsewhere in this court's opinion, it held that there was an unqualified resolution that supplies the PBGC rate for other types of interest rates for the residual annuity calculations. And so the plan administrator made a reasonable interpretation that is entitled to deference under the Supreme Court's decision in Concrete and Frommer. The district court failed to even acknowledge, much less to defer to the plan administrator. My second point is there's a fundamental, going back to the mortality discount, there's a fundamental unfairness here. If the plaintiffs can make an argument that is misleading or misrepresenting with respect to one of the two calculations, because they said the same benefits are paid out regardless of pre-retirement death. That argument was not true for this distinct calculation. And now following this court's opinion, they are asking us to say, well, you could have raised that for before, it's now waived, and even if our argument would not apply here, even if this court's opinion would dictate the different result, too bad, too late. That's not how law of the case works, and that's not how this court had decided these issues.
But I also am not sure that that's a fair characterization of their argument. I think they're saying that it was decided, it's foreclosed, and to the extent to which there's some nuance that leaves it open, you should have been in a position to have been able to present it and have the court rule on it.
Your Honor, it was decided based on their representation and argument that the same benefit is paid out on death regardless of if there is a premature death. And I think that they are incorrect. When you look at the plan itself, your normal retirement benefits are paid out to your beneficiaries. There's a lump sum that's in Section 5 of the plan. The residual annuity amendment is distinct. That was adopted later. It is clear from the text of that amendment that there is no death benefit, that there is supposed to be a mortality discount applied that's common and accepted under ERISA, and therefore they just misunderstand that you do lose something with the residual annuity, that you don't with the lump sum, and all we're asking for is to take into account that benefit you get if you decide to retire early and lock in money that you might have lost if you happen to die early.
This is probably going to sound like a dumb question because I haven't fully thought it through, but when you're saying there's no death benefit for the residual annuity. Yeah. If the person who holds it, the residual annuity is a beneficiary, it's other than the retiree, right, other than the employee.
The beneficiaries never hold the residual annuity, Your Honor. It's only after kind of as someone retires. If you're a current employee and you haven't retired.
No. But if you die, if you're an employee and you die before electing retirement benefit.
There's no residual annuity.
There's no residual annuity in that case at all.
No.
It's not that your beneficiary gets a residual annuity that would. Well, your beneficiary would be entitled to age 65.
They get the lump sum. They get their ordinary benefits, but they don't get the surplus, this extra in the plan.
Well, that's interesting because I thought the whole concept of the residual annuity is that it's not a surplus. It's actually just making up the...
It makes up the difference in the mismatch, but that's what the age 65 residual annuity is. So if you retire at 65, you get $100, let's say. That can go to your beneficiaries if you die.
Right.
This is a different question, is if someone retires early, that's not accounting for the mismatch. That's just a typical early retirement factor. And so if you decide not to take your benefits, not to elect a lump sum before you retire, your beneficiaries will get your ordinary retirement discounts. They won't get the amendment. They won't get the residual annuity. That's just gone. And that's why it makes perfect sense to apply the mortality discount in that circumstance.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
Yep.
Appreciate your arguments, both of you. I think that concludes. Oh, we have a couple of... That concludes today's argument in this case.